So thanks, Steve, and everybody else for the invitation. So I'm going to talk about information processing and what I'm calling convex operational theories. I guess that's what I decided to call it this week. Sometimes you'll hear these called generic probabilistic theories. I think John Barrett uses that term, or general probabilistic theories. So this is a framework that's very similar to the one developed by Lucien, and it actually has a lot of antecedents from the 60s and 70s for describing theories where your main concern is you can manipulate the system in various ways. What are the probabilities of various outcomes of such an attempt to manipulate the system? A measurement, or one measurement followed by another measurement, and so forth. Okay, now this is not going forward, which is odd. Okay, so this is part of the general research program that I've embarked on with collaborators, and you can also find other people in often coming from quantum information doing a very similar thing. And it's to study information processing in this very general framework. And one thing we're interested in doing is to characterize quantum theory and maybe classical theory within this broad framework of what some people call foil theories, right? Theories that contrast with quantum and classical and may not have anything to do with reality, but are mathematically possible. And you know, people have been trying to characterize quantum theory in this way for quite a while, and some with some success. But what we're adding, and what really comes, I think, from the advent of quantum information theory, this way of thinking, is we're thinking about axioms and assumptions that help characterize these theories in the way information processing works. Now, why would one bother to do this? Well, there's actually some fairly pragmatic reasons, at least pragmatic theorists. It gives you a conceptual understanding of information processing itself. You may understand what sorts of principles, very broad general principles, like the no cloning or information disturbance trade-offs, what kinds of principles lie behind certain tasks that you might want to do. And maybe this kind of understanding can help you develop new protocols, understand more than we now know about the limits of quantum information processing. Or maybe it can help you model information processing in other complex systems or concurrent systems. I mean, there are some somewhat related formalisms to the one I'm going to talk about that have been developed, for example, for studying concurrence in parallel computing, things called process algebras. And then there's the more hubristic reasons. There are people who think maybe information is the essence of quantum physics. And maybe if we think about principles that are satisfied in quantum mechanics, and some of them not satisfied in classical mechanics, in terms of information, we might get an analog of Einstein's principle-based way of understanding special and general relativity. I'm not really committed to thinking that this is actually going to work out, but it's a possibility. All right. I think I'm just sort of pointing out that it was recognized, actually, even by some of the founders of quantum mechanics, that some of the weird quantum phenomena were really an informational break with classical physics. State disturbance, inevitable state disturbance, entanglement. Schrodinger described it in terms of ways, at least I understand, as pure composite states can have mixed marginals in quantum theory, whereas they can't in classical theory. That's a very information-oriented way of thinking about things already. And the other thing I wanted to point out is, there may be many illuminating characterizations or axiomatizations of quantum mechanics. And so the fact that I'm still looking for one, even though there are various, at least partial or pretty close characterizations, like those of Hardy, Dariano. There's a nice one by Araki in the 80s, which is closely related to a mathematical characterization that really goes back to, I think, Kocher and Vinberg, which I'll talk about later. And there's some success in terms of quantum logic. Again, not all of these are in terms of operational principles. There's some mathematical formal principles still, and certainly not all in terms of information processing. But so to keep looking for characterizations isn't to say that there's nothing useful in these, and in fact, there is. So the basic, broad basic idea is when you want some formalism where we've got systems, column A, B, and C, and each system has a convex set of states, which we're typically going to call omega sub A or omega sub B, et cetera, a convex sets of measurement outcomes, and there's a reason for using this unit interval notation. These are effects between the zero functional and the functional that always takes the value 1 on the states, basically. So there should be a bilinear map between from states and outcomes to probabilities. This is just saying that these things that give you the probabilities, these measurement outcomes, are linear functionals on the states, if you like. This idea of a convex set of states is sort of abstract, but if you want an operational account of how you get to it, read Lucy and Hardy's papers. You take up all the possible experiments or enough to characterize the states and, look at each way of preparing a system. What's the list of probabilities you can get for all the different outcomes of all these different experiments? That's, put this down as a big list of real numbers. Look at the span of those for all the different preparations and project into some smaller vector space where this thing will be represented. And you'll get some convex set of states. We're going to want, to say be able to talk about dynamics and also ways of making composite systems, or at least of recognizing that a given system can be viewed as a composite system. So as things get more technical, please ask questions if it's not clear. Because the longer you've been working with stuff, the less you start understanding what is going to hang people up. And it's really pretty simple. So, just to summarize some of the main results of this program before we go through them selectively, and we'll get all of them. Early on, this is me, John Barrett, Matt Liefer, Alex Wills. We were able to show that a set of states can be cloned if and only if the states are perfectly distinguishable. So they're really a classical subset of pure states, if you like. It's broadcastable, and that's like cloning, but you're doing it to mixed states, and you allow the copies to be correlated, not necessarily completely independent. It's if and only if it's in a classical subset of mixed states, if you like. Information disturbance, and what I'm going to be focusing on here, so these are all things that really talk about the nature of classicality in these theories. I'm not going to focus on that so much, partly because I think Matt and John and maybe even Alex have talked about this here before. I'm going to focus on things that actually enable you to differentiate between different non-classical theories. In particular, those are teleportation and bit commitment is what I'm going to concentrate on. So we've got necessary conditions for conclusive teleportation I'll talk about, and sufficient conditions for deterministic teleportation. Now, so conclusive is post-selected, right? You know you succeeded, but you don't always succeed. You just know it when you do. And bit commitment. So with Oscar Dalston, Matt Liefer, and Ben Toner, we showed that an exponentially secure bit commitment protocol is possible in any non-classical theory that does not have entanglement. Finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about conditions for ensemble steering, or if you like, a generalization of the Huston-Josa-Wooters theorem. That's the theorem that, with a pure entangled state, you can make any ensemble for one marginal as the ensemble of conditional states, conditional on the outcomes of a measurement at the other site. It will turn out this helps you defeat this kind of bit commitment protocol. We'll see why. So now a little bit into the background. Can I ask how many people are pretty familiar with this formal way of formulating theories in terms of a cone of unnormalized states and a dual cone of effects or measurement outcomes? Just raise your hand if you are. Okay, good. So then please ask questions if this isn't making too much sense. And it may help to keep in mind how quantum mechanics is a special case of this. So if you're not seeing how quantum mechanics is a special case of this, then ask for more information on it. Okay, so we're going to deal with finite dimensional real vector spaces. And a cone in such a space is just a subset of the space that's closed under positive, or rather non-negative scalar multiplication. It's closed under addition. So the conjunction of those two things, by the way, means that it's convex. And in addition, we're going to assume it's pointed. So it doesn't contain any subspaces except the null subspace that's spanned by the zero vector. Or another way of saying it is that the cone intersect its negative is zero. Okay, and since these are going to be cones of unnormalized state spaces, and we're going to take their normalized elements, right, we're going to pick some functional in the dual space and say, well, when this functional is 1, we call these normalized states. So we're slicing through this cone to get a set of normalized states. We want it to be pointed, because if it's not, that slice isn't going to be compact, and it's not going to have a sensible probabilistic interpretation. So that's the reason for this. So in general, if I've got a set and then I do some operation to it formally, that means I'm thinking of the set that's created by doing this operation to every element of the set.
And it's minus 1?
No. I'm saying that, okay, where's the chalk? So here is R2. Okay, let's say here is our cone. Always good to have examples. So it's these two rays and everything between them, and it goes out to infinity in that direction, includes the origin. So that's, this is k, let's say. Okay, here's minus k. Okay. Multiply everything by minus 1, yeah. Multiply, yeah.
By minus 1. So, but it doesn't matter. I guess it's a linear space, and you're just taking the convex.
Well, I mean, minus k is also a cone. It's closed under, it is a cone. It's closed under positive scalar multiplication.
It's all right.
It's just you take everything here, and you multiply, you take its negative, and that's minus k. Although I don't think I'm ever going to use it again. Nope, I did. Okay, so another way to think about these cones is, right, they order the vector space. So let A be the underlying finite dimensional real vector space. There's an ordering. A is less than or equal to B if B minus A is in the cone. And the ordering has nice properties. You can add inequalities. You can multiply by positive scalars, just what you'd expect. And you know, the two ideas are pretty much equivalent. If you've got a nice order, I can find you a nice cone. We are going to be assuming that our cones are also generating. So that means the linear span of the cone is the whole vector space. Sometimes it's nice, actually, to look at one of these theories in a larger vector space than it spans, right? As the state space of a single Popescu Wurlick bit is perhaps an example. I would say it is. You usually give 4 numbers for that, but the cone actually spans a 3-dimensional space. But if you try to make a nice representation of it in 3D, you're going to wind up with some nasty numbers that you just don't have around. So sometimes it's convenient not to have it generating, but in the abstract, you might as well do this. Okay, so henceforth, cone means it's generating. It's topologically closed. I'll add that. And it's pointed convex, and so forth. So that's our notion of a space of unnormalized states. Yeah, Adrian?
In quantum mechanics, the cone is the unnormalized density matrices.
Yes.
But you're working in a real vector space.
Yeah.
Mission operators.
Yeah, so, yeah, I realize that. But so in this case, the vector space is 2 n squared dimensional.
I think it's just n squared.
It's just n squared.
Yeah. So you've got.
Okay. So it's just the Hermitian operators.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So the fact that this embeds
so
nicely.
Even though the entries of these matrices are complex, we're still thinking of them as.
Yeah. They're Hermitian.
Yeah.
And so you know there's I minus I or something is like
a basis element for these are in the IJ and the KL and the LK. Does that make sense to everybody? I mean, permission operators are a real, permission operators on C to the N are a real N-squared dimensional vector space. That's the ambient vector space in which this cone exists for quantum mechanics, the cone of positive semi-definite matrices.
Could you just briefly touch on the definition of generating again?
Yeah. So one way I put it was that K minus K is the whole space. Let's say the space is called A. Right? I mean, K minus K here just means I can take positive and negative scalars and combinations. So it's just saying...
In other words, there exists a basis for the entire vector space within the cone.
Yeah, exactly. It spans the vector space.
Within the cone and below the cone.
No, you don't. Well, you don't need minus K because when you say there exists a basis, you're giving yourself minus K. You give yourself a positive and negative scalars
right,
and
right,
span
right.
the vector space. So, I mean, the cone is the positive span of itself, and the vector space is the span under all of the combinations. Okay, so we're going to define an abstract state space. It's a pair of an ordered linear space A and a fixed, you know, positive linear functional, and it actually should be strictly positive on the interior of this cone. And it's often called the order unit. And it's just used, in our case, to kick out a set of normalized states, right? They're the states on which this functional value gets to 1. What is it in quantum mechanics? It's just the trace. Okay. Examples, you know, classical finite number of event of atomic events, probability theory, it's just, you know, Rn is your ambient space, Rn plus is the cone, right, positive orthant, and then you just cut it with some plane, which is the plane where some linear function is 1, and you get a probability simplex as your normalized states. Quantum mechanics, I think we've discussed enough. Won't have any need for other funky examples. Okay. I already mentioned that measurement outcomes are linear functionals. And we basically want them to be, you know, these are what give us probabilities, given a state. And we want them to be linear because we want to preserve convex combinations, right? So if I, you know, do some convex combination of ways of preparing something, then I make a measurement outcome. The probability, I get a certain measurement outcome. The probability of getting that outcome should be the convex combination, that same convex combination of the probabilities I would have gotten if I had prepared it in each of those two ways. Does that make sense? I mean, there's similar sort of operational motivations for, you know, everything I'm saying is convex in this theory. That's the motivation. Yeah?
From the effect itself?
Oh, I'm just calling it the same. Yeah, I think. So it's a pretty abstract notion about it. Right, so you just apply this linear functional to the state and you get the probability of an outcome. Okay, so that means it's going to be in the dual cone, right? What's the dual cone? It's the cone in the dual vector space, right, which is just the linear functionals on the primal space, which consists of all those functionals whose values is not negative
on every element of the primal cone. Yeah. So here I have a primal cone, right? This guy. Let's draw the dual cone for that. Do you guys have colored chalk? Yeah. All right. No, I don't think so. This is 90 degrees, and that's 90 degrees. So because it's 90 degrees, this guy has positive inner product with everything in the cone, and so does this. And so this whole thing is the dual cone, right? If you squeeze this smaller, the dual cone gets wider. If you pick a basis in the cone, I think you cannot necessarily find a basis, a dual basis in the dual cone. But
the question is, there some kind of basis that defines the cone, and then maybe you can take the dual basis of that.
Yeah, I guess a cone isn't.
I think you tend to run into trouble if you assume that, given a basis in the cone, the dual basis to that basis is in the dual, even relative to.
Really?
I think so. I don't want to. I mean, maybe well, we should cover that. But let me just say one thing. I drew these both in the same space, right? And actually, the dual cone lies in the dual space. So it's not really legitimate to say the dual cone is in the same space unless you have assumed some isomorphism between the primal space and the dual space. So that's effectively what I've done. We're using the Euclidean inner product here where we assume that what looks orthogonal on the board is orthogonal. Okay. And that's fine once you've specified an isomorphism between a space and a dual space. And we'll get back to that. Okay, so, yeah, Robin.
Are you going to work in infinite dimensional spaces here or just finite?
No. No to the first part.
Oh.
No infinite dimensional spaces. So that's the other part. So I'm going to define something a little more than the abstract state space I just defined, right?
And the type I just defined is a maximal state space, where we sort of say the effects, right, the legitimate measurement outcomes, are the full unit interval in the dual cone. So anything that's like logically or reasonable probability, we're going to allow in. You can also make up theories, and this is important if you want to understand stuff like Rob Speckin's work, which we call non-maximal. And so you take some subcone, A sharp, let's say, of the dual cone, and you look at the unit interval in there. So A sharp's got to contain your unit functional that tells you which states are normalized. And that's important because I think basically anything Rob would call a non-contextual, a theory that's not classical but has a non-contextual hidden variable theory, it's going to be non-maximal in this sense. I can't guarantee you that, but I think that's so. Okay. And, well, okay. Let's get a category here. Okay, measurements are just like they are in quantum mechanics, right? We have our unit interval where the effects lie, right? Effects being our jargon for what are called POVM elements often in quantum mechanics. So a discrete measurement, let's say, or sometimes we might even call it an observable, is just a set of effects that add up to the unit effect, right? It just forces that the probabilities out for one. We'll call it informationally complete if the effects actually span the vector space they live in. And that means that if you know their probabilities, you know the state. You know their probabilities in a particular state, you know the state. We could have continuously indexed measurements if you want to get technical. Yes?
At some level, this is just definitional, right? But
pretty much, yeah, most of what we've been doing is definitional.
Yeah, it seems like implicitly you're imagining, well, suppose you had a theory where the state space was the state space that you've been describing.
I haven't described it, but this is a framework for
a state space that satisfies these definitions that you've been giving.
Mm-hmm.
So now it seems like this slide is adding an extra physical assumption that these measurements are actually realizable in this hypothetical theory.
Okay. So I guess I'd want to say that even the previous slide was really adding that. So by saying that I'm thinking of these measurements as, what to say? I mean, when I define a theory, I'm thinking of, you know, saying what the states are and what the effects are,
right,
and that they are realizable.
Right.
So I'm kind of assuming they're realizable. And that's why I wanted to throw in the possibility that not everything, you know, that looks reasonable, that will give you reasonable probabilities, is necessarily realizable in a given theory. So if you want to be able to formulate a theory where not everything that's logically reasonable probability is okay, you can formulate it in this framework by picking out a subcone A sharp. Right. But you're doing more than just saying, well, I have A and I have this unit function. If you do that, then you've got this maximal theory where everything mathematically consistent is measurable. So we could say, you know, I'm going to specify A sharp in U.
Okay.
I think your second line there, the non-maximal thing, is a mathematical statement of what an epistemic restriction is.
I think that's pretty much what I was saying when I said you need this stuff to understand ROMs and sort of blind detection errors.
Right, so what I'm curious about.
Well, it's not exactly the same as epistemic restrictions, right? He's got some underlying ontic space which isn't necessarily, you know, a space of things that.
Well,
yeah, so I don't know. Maybe it comes out the same thing. Maybe not.
So my question is related to that. The epistemic restriction is usually phrased as a restriction on what states can exist, and that I think is connected with this through update rules. And so far, you've only talked about probability rules, not update rules. So,
well, I will get to update rules.
Okay.
But yeah, let me just. I mean, this is connected to Rob's ideas about non-potential hidden variables. I don't want to say exactly how it connects to hidden variable theories or quantum state spaces. That was simple restrictions. But it definitely is in that general area. So, okay. So speaking of updated rules, what about dynamics? And you know, in some formulations of this, it's actually more sensible to start with dynamical maps in the first place. Allow them to happen with probability not necessarily equal to one, and then define effects as, you know, the things that give you the probabilities for some dynamic. Okay. So a positive map is just a linear, from like one ordered linear space to another, is just a map, you know, linear map that takes the positive cone of this space into the positive cone of that space. Or it preserves the order if you're thinking of it in the order.
Sorry,
Adam. Yeah?
Is that just a misplaced full stop in the middle of that?
Yes, it is. Sorry. I should go there. Oh, well, that was left. All right. So, you know, this is just like a positive map in quantum mechanics. Completely positive maps are an example. Okay, we're going to call it an ordered isomorphism. If, or we usually just say isomorphism, if it's one to one, but it takes one cone onto the other cone as well. And it's equivalent to just saying it's invertible and it has positive, its inverse is positive.
Okay, and then if there is an isomorphism between two of these cones, we say they are isomorphic, and write it this way. So an automorphism is an isomorphism from a ordered linear space or a cone to itself. And the automorphisms form a group. It's not hard to see. Well, they're invertible, and you know, the identity is one. Okay. So automorphisms are kind of important. If those don't make sense, please let me know. What are the automorphisms in quantum mechanics? They're just the maps. X goes to AX, a dagger, where A is non-singular. And let's say that the group generated by that and X goes to X transpose, which is also an automorphism, although it's not completely positive. So just to make that a little more notion, a little more concrete. All right. So let's say that a reasonable dynamics for an abstract state space is some cone of positive maps from the space to itself. The cone should be closed under composition and should contain the identity. So this ought to sound like we might be moving towards a category theoretic formulation, and we are, but not in this topic. Oh, wait a second. Like I said, not in this topic.
Right.
Oh, really? Yeah, but on the beginning, you'll notice in the beginning it said Perimeter Institute in October 2008.
Oh, okay.
I evidently didn't change every text entry. It's pretty different, actually.
Sure, yes.
Anyway. Okay. So an operation, what we're going to call an operation, a norm non-increasing positive map. Right. In other words, one is such that it's just telling you what norm non-increasing means. It's not really a restriction. So in other words, if you apply this unit functional to phi of a state, it's less than or equal to the unit functional of the state itself. Right, just the generalization of what we call quantum operations. And this unit functional actually can be extended, or you can derive a norm from it, called the base norm. Okay, an instrument, what's often called an instrument, is a set of norm non-increasing maps that sum to a norm-preserving one. So it's like a measurement, but it also tells you what happens conditional, what state change is conditional on each measurement outcome. Okay. Now, I think we're going to need to speed up a little. Okay, so we talked about how you can represent the action of these linear functionals by putting them in the primal space with some isomorphism L, and then just evaluating, you know, if you take X in the primal space, take X in the primal space, put it in the dual via L, evaluate it on Y, that gives you an inner product in the primal space. In quantum case, it's just the trace inner product. We don't need the dagger because of intermission. So we call the internal dual in this kind of representation A star. It's the set of everything with positive that has positive inner product with everything in the primal. And the point of doing this is saying if we can find such a representation L where the dual, the internal dual, is equal to the primal cone, not just isomorphic but equal, then the cone is called self-dual. Quantum theory and classical theory are self-dual. But, you know, your typical cone is not. In fact, there's a theorem that's very interesting, first from 1958. It was in German, so I haven't read it. But also, Vinberg has several nice papers a little bit later that do this. So, suppose we have an irreducible, I'll say what that means in a little bit, finite dimensional self-dual state space. And suppose it's homogeneous. And what homogeneous means is that if you look at the automorphism group, it acts transitively on the interior of the cone. So acting transitively means you can find a group element that takes any one thing to any other thing. So if you act transitively on a set, take any pair of things in the set, and find a group element that takes the one to the other. Okay, and quantum mechanics has this problem. Okay, so if it's homogeneous and self-dual, then it is essentially a set of density operators on an n-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, this includes Hilbert spaces over the reals and the appropriate generalization over the quaternions. So this is actually real quaternionic for complex quantum mechanics. Or the state space is a ball in arbitrarily high dimensions. Or it's this one weird counterexample, this one weird, not exceptional case, 3x3, positive semi-definite, generalized, positive semi-definite matrices over the octonions. So it gets you pretty close to quantum mechanics to say that state space is homogeneous and self-dual. So these are nice mathematical properties. It might be worthwhile to understand more about what's their information processing interpretation or implications. This theorem might be one route to try to go through to get to an informational characterization of quantum mechanics. Two questions. I'll get you guys a turn. Rob?
Two questions. one in three were, I understand one in three. I'm not sure what you mean by a ball. Second question is, where does affine come in here?
Okay. Yeah, forget affine. It's isomorphic.
You don't understand two, but you understand one and three.
Okay. Yeah, okay. A ball. So
that's a tough one.
So here's a ball in R2. I mean, this is
you can pull the other one down.
Here in RM.
What?
Howard, you can pull that other one down. Use the hockey stick.
So a ball. Here's a ball in R2. It looks like this. We make it the base for a cone in R3, and the cone looks like your famous ice cream cone, or Lorentz cones of the ball. So, all right, so the state space is just this disk, or the state space is just the block sphere, right? So these categories overlap in some cases, right? That's the ball in R3, that's the base of the cone in R4, and you can just keep getting higher and higher dimension. So that's what a ball is.
Do you mean according to Euclidean metric? Because the one ball is
okay. Make it an ellipse, and then it's not finally isomorphic. It doesn't really matter.
So an ellipsoid would be okay as well. What about a cube?
It would be okay, but it would be operationally indistinguishable because we haven't specified an inner product, right?
Okay.
If you want it to look, if you want to exhibit itself duality, then you would choose the Euclidean inner product to look like a ball.
So
we had a question from back there, and then I'll.
It seems like this, you know, because I lost the definition of A plus.
Oh, okay. So I told you I'd come back and tell you what irreducible is. So a cone, I do have a slide on it someplace, but I'll just do it for it. A cone is reducible if you can write it as a direct sum of two other cones. So let's say C equals plus over I, CI. And what a direct sum means is that the extremal points, they're subspaces, you know, a disjoint, except for the zero vector set of subspaces, such that every extremal point is contained in one of these subspaces. And so the point is, the information about which of these components the thing is in, a state is in, is classical information. There is only mixture of things from these different components, no superposition, if you like. So any finite dimensional cone is a direct sum of irreducible cones, right? Cones where you can't break it down any farther. And so if you understand the irreducible ones, you really understand them all, because they're just, you can just take an assortment of them and then allow mixtures of things from each one. So classical simplex is a direct sum of one-dimensional cones. It's n-dimensional. It's a direct sum of n one-dimensional cones. And that's why it's not covered directly in here. But it is self-dual because the one-dimensional cones. Yes?
What is the last one referring to?
The last one.
I think state spaces or something. What's that referring to?
It's referring to formally real Jordan engines. Otherwise known as Euclidean Jordan engines.
Is that an A or omega or?
What?
What's the state spaces referring to? Omega or A or?
Well, let's say it refers to omega. I mean, since this is in terms of a normalized state space, right? I mean, we could have also described it in terms of the cone of unnormalized states. I don't want to get into this too much, but if you're into mathematics, that's another connection.
Is it safe to say we can just forget about octonions for the rest of the
talk? Actually, you know, the whole last 15 minutes.
Okay.
Yes, it's safe. Was that your question? Or you had
no, well, it's not. Well, no, I don't have.
Okay.
If we can forget about octonians, I don't have a question.
Good. So a weaker condition is that the thing is isomorphic to its dual, right? And it's not actually the same as being self-dual. Example is, you know, draw a cone with a square base. There it is. It's in R3. It's about infinity. The dual cone looks like this. Same shape, but rotated by pi over 4. Okay. How are we going to describe composite systems? So let's say a tensor product of state spaces A and B is a state space. So the underlying vector space is just a tensor product of vector spaces. And that's actually quite a strong illustration. And then the positive cone in the composite, well, it's really hard to pick one canonically in general. So we're going to have to allow any cone that is positive on product effects and that contains all pure product states, right? So pure product states are the unentangled states. Contain all the unentangled states, and of course, you've got to, you know, not come up with a negative number if you measure a product of two effects. Presumably it's reasonably supposed to do that. And the order unit is just, you know, product. Okay. So I'm just going to point out.
Does that mean tensor product is not unique?
Well, yes. That means that when you specify a composite system, you say I have A and I have B,
you have a whole lot of choices of how to specify a composite system. So when you're making up a theory, you actually have to say how systems combine in that theory. And you know, if you have structure in the systems, like homogeneity or self-duality, then one of the first things you're going to ask is, can I find any tensor product that still has that nice property? And that may help guide you to the choice, right? So in quantum mechanics, there's if you just take two quantum systems, there is this huge spectrum of possibilities, right? From saying the states are only the unentangled states, to saying the states are those that correspond to all positive maps with the Schrödinger Minkowski estimates. In which case, you better not allow entangled effects. And quantum mechanics kind of takes a happy mean in there. And it's also a happy mean that happens to have the nice properties of homogeneity and self-duality that these other things don't have.
Right. So, the point is that since we only have, the only linearity we have is on the space density matrices, you know, mm-hmm. mixed curve, but not mm-hmm. superposition as an inherent property. So, okay.
Yeah. So, right. Examples, okay, we just call it the minimal tensor product of the unentangled states. Convex hull, convex hull of the product states, the unnormalized product states, let's say. The maximal tensor product is the opposite, so it's all states that are positive on product effects. As I just said, in quantum mechanics, the actual tensor product is in between those two extremes. So we'll say, if it's not a convex combination of product states, it's entangled. Similar thing for effects. Easy to define marginal states. Just plug in the unit in one pole of the state, and it just tells you what you'll get if you measure anything on the other side. Okay. I just want to point out that this is not, this notion of compositeness, even though it's pretty general and allows a lot of stuff, it's not non-trivial. So it embodies no signaling between subsystems. And that's, I think, a reasonable thing that you might want to say it's sort of part of our notion of subsystem. That two things are distinct subsystems, you shouldn't be able to signal from one to the other. And it embodies the local observability assumption. And what this basically is that you can determine the state by doing local tomography, finding out the expectation value of a basis of observables on each side. But doing it where you look at the correlation. So Alice and Bob measure, Alice measures this, Bob measures that, and they communicate their answers. And so they can see the statistics of correlations. The fact that this lies in the tensor product vector space, and in fact spans it, is what's giving you this local observability. If you had some extra dimensions that pop in there when you combine systems, you don't have local observability anymore. And that's not as unreasonable as you might think, because if you want to do real quantum mechanics, the natural way to combine two real quantum systems is to say, let's take the tensor product of the underlying vector spaces, and then let's look at the real symmetric matrices on those and the positive semi-definite cone in that. And you'll find that that does have an extra dimension pop into existence. It's basically sigma y tensor sigma y. You don't have sigma y in the original thing, because it's not real symmetric, but when you take the tensor product, you do get something real symmetric. So that's an interesting arena to explore, is what if we weaken that local observability assumption.
Do you understand the no-signaling assumption?
I don't want to say too much about it, because you can't really formulate the no-signaling assumption very well in this framework. It's just automatically satisfied, I guess, is what I'm going to say. But I can tell you what it is. What it is that if Alice, nothing Alice can do on her side will affect the probabilities of measurement outcomes on Bob's side. Nothing she can do, if you don't condition, right, nothing that she can do with probability one can affect the probability of any measurement outcome on Bob's side. To actually formulate theories in which it doesn't happen, you might need to use a slightly different formalism of test spaces, which some of you may have heard talks about. But
Okay, one more thing. So then we can define tripartite composites and larger composites, you know, either by direct generalization of this thing. So just say, oh, it's, you know, it's somewhere in between, you know, the convex hull of all the multipartite product states and the set of multilinear forms that's positive on all product states. Or you can recursively define it using the bipartite definition. I'm not sure those two approaches give you the same thing. But what we need to do when we go into multipartite situations is add a requirement we call regularity. And so what that is we say, well, if we condition on some product effects in subslots, you know, on some subsystems, we still want a valid local state of the composite in the other systems. And kind of surprisingly, this is not a trivial requirement. And I guess an example here is if you try to take the unentangled product here and the unentangled product there, and then the maximal thing here, it turns out that if you condition on certain things that are allowed, like maybe you take these middle two systems and you do an entangled measurement, you kind of do entanglement swapping. I mean, not too surprising. You can sort of do entanglement swapping and come up with an entangled state here where there shouldn't be entanglement. So if you rule things out like that, you need this regularity. It's too difficult to go into in much detail, I think. Okay. I think we've talked about classicality and, you know, how to distinguish classical from non-classical. I just want to say a lot of things that are sometimes thought of as peculiarly quantum are pretty much generically non-classical. But I'm going to emphasize things in the rest of the talk that are not common to all non-classical theories. Emphasizing. Okay. So remote evaluation, which is quite similar to teleportation. And I think this actually works a little better with a picture of a company. These guys, I'll bet you that's why they're.
you can raise both. There's three layers of black.
All right.
There's another.
Okay. So let's say we have a tripartite composite. And we have some state omega on BC, and maybe some effect F on AB, and maybe some state, unknown state alpha here. So we started in alpha tensor omega, and then we get the measurement outcome FAB. So this is kind of like a teleportation setup where, you know, omega would be the Bell state. You know, this would be actually a division between Alice and Bob. Sorry about the B. And this would be the Bell measurement outcome. So what does this look like in the general framework? Okay. Well, let's look a little more closely at bipartite states. So say we have some bipartite state. So saying it's an A tensor max B just means it's a legal state for one of our tensor problems. So we can condition on the occurrence of an effect F by just defining, you know, omega sub F, the conditional state. When you evaluate the conditional state of G, you get omega, the original state of F tensor G. So just what you think conditionalizing is. So this map that takes F to omega sub F, I see I don't define it here. But it's a positive linear map, omega to omega sub f, and omega is in A, and this guy is in B star, right? Because you get it goes from A star to B. As you take an effect F, you condition on it, and you get a state on B. So
should that be F going to omega F?
Sorry, F going to omega sub F.
Well, your slide just says that F
is
omega
star. Okay. And, yeah.
So I'm going to call this map omega hat. So whenever I stick a hat on top of a state, I'm turning it into a map. You know, and this is kind of like the Choi-Jeremy-Minkowski isomorphism, I guess, except that in quantum mechanics, so let's say, you know, A and B are the same. Then you get A star to A. But in quantum mechanics, the Choi-Jeremy-Minkowski isomorphism takes you from A to A. And the reason you can do that is because quantum mechanics is self-dual. So A, you know, there's a canonical identification between the thing and its dual, and therefore a map from A star to A canonically gives you a map from A to A. So this is sort of what you have by way of that Choi-Jeremy-Minkowski isomorphism in this general situation. Okay, so what if we have this teleportation-like setup that I talked about here? It's a very simple lemma to just see that if you start with this alpha on A and omega on BC, condition on this F on AB, you just take the state and you run it through the map corresponding to F and the map corresponding to omega. I didn't define the map corresponding to F, but it's sort of obvious that in effect, FAB should correspond to a map, that's, well, a map F hat from, is this too low to see? I guess it is. F hat from A to B star, right? So this thing goes from A to B star, and then this thing takes it to C. Okay? And so if we know what omega and F were, we know what function is being applied here. And in fact, let's say C is isomorphic to A. And let's say that this map that we get, you know, running it through F and omega, is what Alex likes to call physically reversible. So it's invertible, and it has a norm non-increasing inverse. And it's not really important, actually, that the inverse be norm non-increasing. Okay, that means that Charlie, or C, can perform this inverse that we said exists and get back the original state. So this is conclusive teleportation. Right, post-selected on an outcome. Okay. So what if... okay. So let's suppose that, you know, C is isomorphic to A. When can we actually teleport through B by a protocol like I just talked about? Well, it's whenever there is a positive embedding of A into B's dual into a very particular kind of system, which we might call an information-preserving subsystem, in terms that Robin likes to use. So this projection from B dual to itself, and it has this this embedded version of A as its range. So the point is the information from A is going to have to go in teleportation protocol through B dual and then back to C, which is essentially back to A. And so A had better be in B dual. And it actually has to be in it in a really nice way, which basically is a way such that you can get the information back out. And that's what the existence of this projection is. Quantum mechanics is rife with you know, subsystems that are projectively embedded into a given system. So this is sort of getting us close to okay, the easy corollaries of this are, you know, when B is isomorphic to A star, then you can teleport A through B, of course. When B is isomorphic to A, then saying this embedding exists is to say that A is weakly self-dual. So that's getting us a little ways toward quantum mechanics, right? Because in quantum mechanics, we have full self-duality and other properties. But okay, if B is isomorphic to A, a nice open question, actually a question mark here, is when can we teleport with a uniform tensor product, right? So because we have all this freedom of choosing the tensor product, you know, if there's any positive map here that's an isomorphism, we can throw it into the effect cone of AB. And if there's any state that's the nice kind of isomorphism, we can just throw it into the effect cone of B and C. But if all these things are isomorphic,
there's no guaranteeing that this is the same, quote unquote, tensor product in both places, and that, you know, if we had F on AB and omega on AB, that one would be positive when evaluated on the other. So we want to think about when we can do that as another way of perhaps moving towards quantum mechanics. Yeah, probably.
If I'm getting a little bit lost, should I ask the question now or just let you steam on to your conclusion?
Maybe you should let me steam on to the conclusion, yeah. Unless everybody's lost. Okay, so this is the sort of open question that we want to keep investigating to understand more about when we might have quantum mechanics. Entanglement swapping works. Deterministic teleportation, okay. So when can you have a whole measurements worth of outcomes F sub I here and corresponding, you know, correction maps tau I such that no matter which of those outcomes you get, the thing teleports. And you do the correction and you always get back the same one, just like in quantum mechanics. Well, we know some sufficient conditions. We don't know, you know, a nice, necessary sufficient condition. And the sufficient conditions involve having a lot, the cone having a lot of symmetry. The state space is having a lot of symmetry. So let's say there's a finite, and I really don't think this is necessary if you want to generalize the notion of a continuous observable teleportation protocol where a continuum of outcomes have to be communicated from out. But for now, let's say finite, norm-preserving, so preserves the normalized state subgroup of the automorphism group with a unique invariant state omega naught. And you want an isomorphism that takes that unique invariant state on A to the order unit of B. Okay. Then you can do it. And the proof, basically, you just hit this guy on one side of different all the elements of the group, and you use group averaging to show that you can get observable. Okay, so a few more technical things. A sufficient condition for having this omega naught is that G acts transitively on the normalized pure states of A. It's a condition which I think actually would be a consequence of homogeneity, but I'd really have to go through the technical details. The idea being that if you can act transitively on the interior, you can just pick your points in the interior to converge towards any pair of extreme points you want. Okay, and then another technical condition. So if this isomorphism is G equivariant, it will actually have this property. So state space is having a lot of symmetry, and I think actually homogeneity is sufficient. So another property that's quantum mechanics has popping up will work. Okay, I could quickly talk about bit commitment protocol, but since it's 5, I think I will not get into that except to just say what the result is. If there's no entanglement, but you have non-classical theory, you can do bit commitment, and it's basically just the BB84 bit commitment protocol, right, or generalization of it. Just encode the bit into which of two ensembles for a mixed state you're using. Pick a whole string of picks from your chosen ensemble. Alice does that, sends them to Bob. She's committed. And then she just tells Bob which ensemble she used, and basically he can do measurements that will tell him whether or not she really did pick from that ensemble, because, you know, if she didn't, she's not going to be able to convince him that the state over there is what she said it is. And it's exponentially sound in the number of draws from the ensemble that Alice sends over. So it's, you know, reasonably simple proof that a few technical things. The other thing I think I'll say is just that these isomorphism states, so now, how might you defeat bit commitment protocol? So it might be nice to know exactly which non-classical theories permit and which don't permit bit commitment. We don't know that, but we do know that this particular protocol can be defeated if you have enough of these isomorphism states again. Because these isomorphism states allow you to steer their marginals. So it's certainly sufficient for a state to be steering for its marginal if it's an isomorphism state. And again, remember, steering for the marginal means that if you look at, you have omega AB, you take the marginal state omega B, and you write it as some convex combination of other states, you can get that convex combination by making a measurement on the A side and looking at the conditional state conditional on your measurement results. So any convex combination on one side, you get the other. And it's sort of not surprising that that gives you an isomorphism between the two systems. Or if you have the isomorphism, you can get that. And then if every if every state always has some purification, right, some composite state within it's a marginal that allows you to steer it, then this Bitcoin protocol is dead. So that's again saying that ways of combining systems where you have a lot of states that represent isomorphisms are important, and that's also a property that quantum mechanics has. Yeah, in fact, if you have that property, the existence of these purifications for all states, you actually have homogeneity, because you just take this isomorphism, run it backwards, take your favorite marginal here, go backwards with the isomorphism, and you know you're going to get the unit, right, the order unit. So the state goes from A star to B when you do it as a map, and the marginal is just... So if I have omega AB, and I look at the corresponding map, and I apply it to the unit of A, I get the marginal omega B. So now I can go backwards with the inverse of this thing, get UA, and then I can take whatever my state is, which steers my whatever other marginal I have here, and run it forwards and get that other marginal. So I've got homogeneity. So these information processing protocols are connecting nicely, although we still don't have a full picture, with these properties like homogeneity and at least weak self-duality that move you towards quantum mechanics. And there, I think I'll stop.
So do we have any further questions for Howard?
Okay, so the bit where I got lost, actually, I got so lost I can't remember exactly what it said. Can you flip back a slide or two? It was the bit where you're talking about teleporting through B if there were embeddings. Right. So in the quantum case, if the analogy I'm building with the information preserving structures work is accurate, these embeddings are subalgebra projections, right? That A, the way that I embed A into B or B star, since they're isomorphic, is it has to be a subalgebra. Is that?
I don't wanna assert that too strongly. I think in quantum mechanics, the embeddings are as a way I would think about it is that they're a face of the cone. A face of the cone of quantum semiconductor operators. So the technical definition of a face is that it's a set such that, if omega in this set is a convex, so a face of a convex set. If omega is in the face, then so is everything that can appear in a convex decomposition of omega. So what is a face in quantum mechanics? Faces correspond to subspaces of the underlying Hilbert space, and they are just the set of density matrices that is supported precisely on that subspace. Supported on that subspace. And maybe the support can be smaller also. But your support lies in that subspace.
Okay.
So I think I would say, is how these things are going to be embedded, actually, as faces. Because there is a projection onto those faces. It's just conjugation by the projection onto the subspace. Right? So density matrix rho goes to P rho P day.
So then the embedding, for quantum theory here, if I apply this statement to quantum theory, the embedding is A has to be isomorphic to a subspace of B.
Yeah, the density matrices on a subspace of the UI, or with positive semi-definite operators on some space.
So does this definitely not apply to commutative algebras, classical?
Oh, no, I think it would apply to commutative algebras. Yeah.
I mean, I'm working through,
but you can teleport. You can teleport in classical theory, according to this definition.
Okay. So having established that, sorry, my question really was, in the general convex theory that I don't have a good grasp on, are these embeddings still sort of rigid in the sense that when you embed A in B, sort of exterior points go to exterior points, or could you have, you know, A embedded
into
the interior of B?
No, no, it doesn't work that way, because then you can't get it back out. Basically.
Okay.
And having this, so I mean, that's roughly what I would say, but I think there's a little bit to be written about how these things are actually information preserving subsystems. But yeah, you can't switch the thing down in, because otherwise anything would teleport through anything else. You really wouldn't be able to get it back out.
I'm just picking up on a small technical point you raised about homogeneity of the interior being transferable to homogeneity of the boundary.
Uh-huh.
So is your automorphism group guaranteed to be compact?
That's a good point. So yeah, so that may be why this isn't actually fully worked out, is that for the teleportation, what you're talking about is you want a transitive action on the extremal points of the normalized state space. And so the group that does that will be compact. Well, we're actually, in the theorem, we're talking about finite, but everything should work okay for compact groups.
Yeah. So if it's compact, then I think your argument will go through.
Okay.
If it's not, then I can give you a counterexample.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, there may be a problem, though, is going from homogeneity to the full cone to, well, yeah, to achieving the homogeneity on the base, on the interior of the base, of the normalized states, but in such a way that the automorphism group elements that achieve it preserve the entire base. So that may be why homogeneity of the cone of unnormalized states, doesn't necessarily imply this transitive action on the extreme points of the base. So I think that's the hang-up and help you remember.
Because the unnormalized states, but with the unnormalized states, the automorphism group might still be compact. Right?
Well, it'll never be compact.
It's supposed to preserve the normal.
That's the key. It doesn't.
Yeah, then it'll be.
It won't be compact, but you might be able to always represent it in terms of some kind of, I don't know, semi-direct product of some non-compact group of compact one.
So I can tell you the counterexample later. You see if it applies to your.
Okay. Yeah, we should talk about that.
Well, if there are no further questions, let's thank Howard again.